Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
We're going to mix it up a little bit today.
Absolutely.
Tommy's going to tell us a story.
Well, and it's not a railroad story.
So. No, it's more of a nightmare story, honestly.
Yeah, it's something that I couldn't believe. I came across this article one day when I was just killing some time.
And killing time
at work. You know how that goes.
I do know how that goes. Unfortunately, I have to bill my time, so it's hard to kill time when I'm trying to write down my point ones and point twos, because if I don't bill the point ones and the point twos, I don't make any money. So
well, this story caught my eye, and it was hard for me to believe that it was real. It said, for 20 years a Tennessee baby thief kidnapped more than 5,000 children from the streets, hospitals, and shanty towns of Memphis. Now, 70 years later, survivors of her house of horrors are confronting the past. Now, some of you may have heard of this, but I never heard of it.
I had never heard of it either, and you sent it over to me. I think your email said, dude, can you believe this?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, it was just absolutely amazing. I mean, you think about this. This lady stole 5,000 children and basically sold them. I mean, they called it an adoption.
Right.
But adoptions in those days cost roughly $7.
Right.
And she was doing it for like $750 to $2,500.
Right.
Because a lot of the ones that she adopted out were to famous people. People in New York and stuff like that. It wasn't just there in Memphis.
No, I think the way I read it is that if there was an adoption in Tennessee, the state code said that it had to be like $7, which I think by today's standards was like $75 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, not very much money.
Right.
But when she was adopting to people out of state, she could charge a premium for it.
Absolutely. And she did.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. I thought, how could something like this have taken place? Now, this was not current times exactly, but it was for about 20 years from 1927 until 1950.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who are still alive today that were part of this child abduction.
Sure.
Abduction / adoption ring.
I mean, it went on till 1950. I was born 8 years after that. So,
yeah,
you know, hopefully I've got people a little bit older than me still around.
Well, you check the obituaries. That's like you always tell us.
Yeah, check the obituaries, average them out, and see if I'm above or below the line.
It's getting closer every day.
Some days it doesn't look too good. All these young people dropping out with opioids and all.
Well, yeah.
That brings my average down.
Those are outliers.
Is that what that is? Not around here, it's not the outlier. It's almost the norm.
That's true.
It's getting better, though.
It is.
But anyway, I digress.
You do digress sometimes.
All right. This lady's name was Georgia Tan. She was actually born Beulah Georgia Tan. She became the director of the Memphis chapter of the Tennessee Children's Home Society in 1927. Through trickery, deceit, and outright fraud, she stole children from parents through a variety of sources, such as baby scouts, corrupt judges, and even more corrupt politicians. She placed over 5,000 children all over the country, many of them to Jewish families in New York and to stars in California. Birth certificates were rewritten to make the children's background fit the desires of prospective parents. This included taking Christian children and giving them Jewish-sounding names. Other records were destroyed to cover the tracks of the orphanage and their criminal acts of kidnapping.
Yeah, so this was not something she did just on her own. It was pretty much a ring.
Yeah, she had a network.
She had to have different lawyers and judges that were probably in on this and helping her out.
And doctors.
And doctors as well, yeah. I mean, it was not just something she did on her own. This was a widespread ring. I think that's the only really word you can use for it.
Yeah, some of them they would take from their mothers under the pretense of seeking medical care, and then the mothers were later told that the children had died and been buried without notification. And then many of the newborns were just taken, and their mothers told that they had been born stillborns, and their bodies had been removed to lessen their grief.
One of the other things that I read, too, was that they would have younger mothers that they would basically say, well, just sign over your rights to us so that your child will be better off, too. That was one of the things that they did, one of the other ways they did it, too. And it was kind of interesting because in West Virginia, you are actually not allowed to relinquish any kind of parental rights within 72 hours of birth. That's actually part of West Virginia code, and I think that's probably because such an emotional time, you don't want anybody doing that during those time periods. Yeah. You want a bit of a safe harbor.
Maybe they're figuring that the patient, the mother, doesn't have mens rea at that time to make such a decision.
Probably not. I don't think mens rea, well, I guess technically speaking, that might be the right term, but legally speaking, that's not the same term. But yeah, so anybody who is trying to coerce somebody within that window is, that's not good.
Oh, that's why West Virginia enacted that, was to keep people from preying on new mothers that maybe weren't in good financial position or good emotional positions and things like that.
Yeah.
And they actually had people that would drive around. They targeted the poorer sections of town.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they would go into these poor sections and they would look for attractive children. And then a lot of times she would do it herself. She had a big fancy black car and she would pull up and offering the kids candy. She would try to entice him, get in a car, and she'd just simply drive off with him.
And one of the things that I read is about her as well is that this was a time when some of these children had probably never ridden in a car.
Right.
So for them to offer candy and get in a big car to ride with somebody, that was kind of a big deal.
And she was always dressed up and, you know, a fancy-looking, well-to-do lady, so it wasn't like they would look at him and it was like, oh, look out, this person looks scary.
Yeah, and if you see pictures of her, I mean, she does not look like the monster that she was. She looks normal.
Looks like a typical mother or something from that era.
Yeah. Now, she was pretty well-to-do, though, right?
Yeah, her father was a famous judge in Mississippi, and he actually got her in the child care business down in Mississippi. And she started doing what she ended up doing in Memphis. She started doing it down there. And I think after some disappearances and some people kind of figured out what was going on, they ran her out of town.
She actually, since her father was a judge, she aspired to be a judge or a lawyer herself. And she actually read the law under her father and was going to be a lawyer. But her dad, at the time, didn't think that was the right kind of role for a woman. And so he said, no, you need to get into social work. That's something that's kind of acceptable to do. Now, reading the law is kind of a antiquated method that people become lawyers, although it is actually still practiced in certain areas in the United States. And what would take place is that the person would essentially do kind of an extended internship or apprenticeship under the mentorship of an experienced lawyer or judge. And like I said, it's still practiced in California, Vermont, Virginia, and Washington.
Well, that's what Kim Kardashian's doing.
She's reading the law?
Yeah. That's how she's going about becoming a lawyer instead of actually going to law school. Seriously. That's...
I know. I remember the article.
Yeah.
The time that is required to read the law varies by each of these states, and the rules vary as well. Virginia does not allow the reader to be gainfully employed by the tutoring lawyer, so they can't actually work for the lawyer and also read the law, which would kind of, I guess anybody could say, well, I've been reading the law for the past 5 years while making money, so now I'm going to go to law school or take the bar or whatever. Yeah. The Washington requires the person actually to work for the lawyer. So it's the other way around.
Huh. They don't want the lawyer to have free labor, huh?
Maybe not. That's probably the other way around. New York requires the applicants who are reading the law to have at least 1 year of law school, and Maine requires applicants to have completed at least 2/3 of a law degree. So there's different ways it goes around.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they call these people country lawyers or county seat lawyers, which is kind of an antiquated term. You know, a country lawyer.
Yeah.
And so some statistics. In 2013... 60 people became lawyers this way, as opposed to 84,000 from law school.
Well, that's quite a difference.
It is. It's probably not the way that most people go about becoming a lawyer.
It's not the same as a jailhouse lawyer, huh?
No, although there's quite a few of those. So she was well versed in the law and knew basically
how, the ins and outs.
Yeah, she knew how to get away with this.
Whether
much.
She was practicing or not, she was very familiar with the law.
Absolutely.
Because of her father's. Georgia Tan's father, Judge George Tan, used his position to help get her set up in her position in Memphis as the head of the Children's Society.
Well, he got her, I think he got her foot in the door, and then she staged a coup and kind of took over. Took over.
Yeah, she wasn't hired as a director when she went in there.
She had aspirations to be the director.
Yeah, somehow she discredited those above her and rose to that position. Within like a year of being there.
Meteoric rise.
Yeah, she became the head of it. And then that's when she got hooked up with a guy named Edward Hull Crump, or who was known as Boss Crump.
Boss and Crump.
It sounds like one from the good old boys. Who am I trying to think of with their car flying around all over the place?
Dukes of Hazzard.
Dukes of Hazzard.
That was Boss Hogg.
Yeah, it was Boss Hogg. That's what I was saying. That reminded me of that. That's what was going on. But he was the political clout behind Georgia Tan. He wielded great power and influence in Memphis and throughout Tennessee. And he would send his cronies to handle any disputes or problems and use his influence to change laws to fit the needs of Georgia. See, because he was getting kickbacks too.
Yeah. Now, I looked him up a little bit in to find out about him to see what his kind of legacy was. And I mean, he was basically kind of like a big city boss. He used ballot manipulation, patronages for friends. He would pull favors with different people and kind of make things happen. So he was not really a good guy by today's standards, but that was just kind of how things happened back then. And he actually has statues in Memphis and things like that, and he's seen as somewhat a big figure in the city. Although once this came out about his association with Georgia Tan, I think it really hurt his legacy, though.
Well, I would think so. I would hope so. Well, one of the besides though the just horror of them stealing babies and also then turning around and selling them, they also had, while they were in their care, they didn't take very good care of them.
No, they did not.
And it is claimed that over 500 children died while in the care of that Memphis Society Children's Home.
And part of the reason why these children died is they were taken directly from the hospital and placed in this home.
Right.
So they were not. They probably should have stayed in the hospital.
They still needed to be taken care of. Now, what came about during that time that helped somewhat was the development of formula.
Yeah.
At the time, it wasn't much of an option, and you took them from the mother, and they were not getting the nourishment that they needed. Then, once formula was developed and widely available, that aided them in continuing their evil ways.
Also, during that time, the theory of eugenics was becoming pretty popular. It was back in the 20s when she first started doing that. And that was when eugenics was kind of in vogue, I guess. People actually thought that inferior people should be sterilized during that time, that basically they didn't have the right to have a child if they were inferior. It's really kind of a dystopian type future they were putting forth there.
Well, they also, at the time, that was different than now, and it was funny because I was talking to somebody not too long ago, and I was saying something about, yeah, they put them in an orphanage, and I stopped for a minute, and I thought, when was the last time you ever heard about somebody going to an orphanage? And, where is an orphanage? I don't know where one is. What do they do now? Well, I really didn't pay attention. I guess I should have known this, but orphanages at that time in history were the answer to what you do with children that didn't have any parents or weren't wanted or whatever. And so they were put in this institution with the thinking being, this is the best way to get them all standardized and make them good people in society. It wasn't until later in the 60s and 70s where they started doing studies and they were saying institutionalizing these kids, they're turning out with problems. They don't have any self-discipline. They can't make decisions. They've been handed all their structure, and they never had to make any decisions on their own or be self-starters because they just had to follow rules all the time. The other thing was, I mean, it just comes down to basic. They had no one that cared about them. They were getting no love or comfort or anything else. It was just like, you know, being in a boarding school your whole life. So around the 60s and 70s, you had things coming out saying this is not best thing for these children. And that's when they came up with the idea of fostering children. And that's what we have now. That's why there's no orphanages. They do go into temporary care and foster care sometimes before they can place them with a family or something like that.
They're placed with a family in a home.
Yeah.
And that's actually, we have a shortage of foster homes now because of the opioid crisis and all the issues going on.
Yeah. Well, the state of West Virginia is being investigated, their DHHR, because of their failure to meet the needs of these children.
Yeah. There's some horror stories with foster care, but I think overall it's probably a much better system, I think. I mean, in my estimation.
They still don't have a great answer for it, but I can't imagine putting people just in an orphanage and that's where you live. I mean, it's not much different from being in prison or something. And, you know, and she, of course, became an advocate for that, of orphanages and putting children in there. And she made the claim that when they adopted children out, that 100 of our children turn out, on the average, much better than 100 picked from homes at random. The reason is that ours is a selective process. We select the child and we select the home.
Yeah.
So she was saying her children that came from her orphanage were more likely to be successful than just your random kid that grows up in their own house.
Yeah. Well, she told a lot of lies and different things about where these kids came from to parents.
Right.
We're going to get into that more, but I think there might be a possible motion before the court today?
Yes, if it pleases your judgeship, we'd like to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
All right, who's on the docket?
Well, we have back with us our friends at Native. Take care of your body. It's the only place you have to live.
At Native, they create safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day. They create products with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Not convinced? Check out the over 9,000 five-star reviews from their customers.
9,000. That's a lot of happy customers.
That is.
Their products are formulated without aluminum, parabens, and talc.
They're filled with ingredients found in nature, such as coconut oil, shea butter, moisturizer and emollient, tapioca starch, which absorbs wetness.
They never test on animals, and they have free shipping and returns.
Here's the important thing. It works.
It is good.
Making the switch to an aluminum-free deodorant does not mean having to sacrifice on product performance.
Ingredients you know. Less is more with Native. We have fewer, simpler ingredients, so you know everything that's in their deodorant.
And Native has something for everyone. It comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for men and women. Plus, they release new, limited edition, seasonal scents throughout the year. They also offer unscented formula and baking soda-free formula for those with sensitivities.
Classic deodorant scents include coconut and vanilla. That's the kind that I got, and I've been using it for a couple months, and I love it. Lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and eucalyptus and mint.
You know me. I'm a lavender and rose kind of guy.
Yeah, I know that. Well, that mint, that would make your armpits minty fresh.
It would.
Yeah, it'd be like having an Altoid under your arm, maybe.
And there's no risk to try. They're free returns and exchanges in the U.S.
Like I say, I've been using this for a couple months, and I think it's great. And I think that you ought to at least give it a try and see what it does for you.
Absolutely. And right now, there's a special offer. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use our promo code COURT during checkout.
That's 20% off your first purchase, and you just go to nativedeodorant.com and use promo code COURT during your checkout. Mike and Tommy say, smell nice.
Smell nice. I like it. Like a regular Mad Men ad wizard.
Yeah, that's a catchy one.
Smell nice.
That's better than smell bad.
It is. It is. Now, Georgia Tan would actually create a bunch of backstories for these children. She would say that they came from well-to-do families, that the children were just, the parents were too young to have the children. She often told that the parents were in medical school and things like that, and they were too busy to have children, but they wanted to give up the child for adoption. Like you had said previously, there were Jewish families that were looking for Jewish children. Well, that was no problem. She would just basically change their name
right.
to a Jewish sounding name. So she would create all these different backstories when really she was just snatching these kids from anywhere. And part of the problem with some of the, and how this actually comes to light in this day and age, is that some of the children she took were not infants when they were taken. They were actually, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. They remember their biological parents that they were taken from. They were the ones that got in the car with candy and things like that.
Yeah, and she didn't just grab a kid. If there was like a whole family, like there in one case, the oldest girl was 8, and then the other two were like 5 and 3, and she had, in front of her people, had scoped them out and seen that when the mother was gone working, those three were at the house by themselves. She went to the house and took all three of them.
Yeah, she had spotters. Now, here's the thing. This one story in particular, they lived in a river shanty down by the river, which that's usually where you find river shanties.
Yeah. In a trailer down by the river.
And the mother was in the hospital at the time, and the children were in the home by themselves. That sounds like a less than ideal situation. I'm not going to lie.
Right.
But.
And then the mother had no resources.
Yeah.
Like with the police. The police didn't care.
Well,
they didn't follow up on that.
They might have been paid off on.
Well, yeah, they were in the pocket. Yeah.
I mean, she was connected to some of the most powerful people in Memphis. What police officer wants to investigate that and go up against Boss Crump?
Well, not only that, she was considered at this time an expert on adoption. And it's like, she even went to see Eleanor Roosevelt, and Eleanor Roosevelt sought her counsel regarding child welfare. So she was a leading expert. She testified before the Senate about adoption and how to properly go about it. And she was considered a national expert in adoption while she had all these horrors going on.
She was a national treasure.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. In reading about her, one of the interesting things that popped up, and this is not really related to the whole baby snatching scam that she had, but she had a same-sex partner. And back then, there was no same-sex marriage. And so what she did, she actually adopted her partner, and I had never heard of this before. And her partner was an adult. So this was an adult adoption. So I did a little bit of research about that. And this was actually something that took place as a way to kind of get around the fact that there was no same-sex marriage. This was a way for two people to kind of form a family to make sure that they'd have legal inheritance from each other and had the right to see each other in the hospital and things like that. It legally fixed a lot of issues that might come up between same-sex couples. While researching about this, I mean, this is something that happened not that long ago. There are still people that are essentially married by adoption like this, same-sex mm-hmm. couples. Now, one of the problems this might cause is that same-sex marriage is now legal since the Supreme Court in Obergefell ruled that it was legal. So the problem is that the same-sex couples that are now bonded together by adoption, if they try to get married, they're going to run into some problems because
You can't marry your child.
I mean, the reason they did it was because they wanted to have some sort of union.
Right.
But they would have to essentially break that union and then get married.
Well, you can't unadopt somebody, can you?
There's probably some ways to do it. And most likely a court would be sympathetic to it, given the fact of where we are in this day and age. But yeah, it could cause some serious problems. I mean, you might, if you tried to marry somebody who you legally adopted, you could be charged with criminal incest. 25 states actually have laws on their books, which say that a relationship between adoptive parents and their adult child fits within the definition of incest. So it could be a real problem if that's the way you went about trying to have a relationship.
Yeah, I think you're pretty much stuck with what you tried to pull off there.
Yeah.
And wouldn't be able to undo it.
But again, this goes to show that she knew she knew the law and she knew how to kind of get around things and make things work for her. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I had never heard of that before, but it was something that was kind of prevalent back then.
Yeah. Now, because of her national stature, there were people that sought her out to, if they were looking to adopt. And some of the names on that list, well, they're older actors, so
yeah,
not all of you may be familiar with them, but you can Google them. They were pretty well known. But actors, authors, and entertainers such as Dick Powell, June Allison, Lana Turner, Pearl Buck. She was from West Virginia. Yeah. The Good Earth, I think it was. Yeah. And Smiley Burnett, New York Governor Herbert Lehman. And they all adopted babies from her. Joan Crawford adopted twins, Kathy and Cindy, which, you know, little did they know, but they're adopting these kids that are probably stolen. Now, the kids are going off to good homes, although I don't know, Joan Crawford and her no-wire coat hangers.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how good that was, but, you know, they're going off to these homes of the rich and famous and stuff like that.
And that's one thing that I see sometimes in my practice whenever I do these abuse and neglect cases. You'll have some parent who, or some parents, who might have a drug problem or something like that, and so it forces the Department of Health and Human Resources, CPS essentially, to take the child out of the home and place the child in foster care while the parent tries to fix their drug problem or whatever led to the filing a petition to take the child out in the first place. Now, a lot of times these foster homes, they're well-to-do families who can provide for these children much better than the biological parents. But the thing happens is when the parents, they have a case plan. If they complete the case plan, they go through drug therapy, rehabilitation, all that, and they fix everything they're supposed to do. Sometimes you run into the problem where people don't want to return the kids to the biological parents because they feel they'd be better off with this more wealthy family. And that's just not right. And I've come across that a bunch of times, and it's always hard because you see these children who are really doing well and thriving and having every need met and or could probably have a very affluential type life. Is affluential a word?
Good enough.
Okay. Close enough.
Yeah.
But they'll take them from the foster home and place them back to their parents who are maybe less socially, economically gifted. And the child might not do as well there. They might not have the same opportunities, but that's where they belong because that's their biological parent.
Right.
So that's kind of, she probably would say, well, the child would be better off with these parents anyway, so that's why I'm taking them. That was probably her mindset.
Well, she was responsible for creating a lot of the laws on adoption in Tennessee. She would go to this Crump fella and say, this is what we need it to be. And he would get the law put in so that it favored her for her to be able to do what she wanted. And like you said, she would make up different backstories as to, you know, what happened and how these children came into their possession, and, you know, that they were always helping them out.
She would actually, to show how what kind of scruples she had, she would actually shake down people for more money as well.
Right.
So if the child was adopted out, she would contact them and say, well, the biological parents have come back, and they want to try to undo this adoption.
If you give me $500, I've got a lawyer that says he can fight that for you.
Yeah, and get it taken care of. Just completely fabricating the whole deal.
Right. You just go back and get it. So she was very slick. And another thing that she did that I found was unbelievable, she would run a national ad with a picture of like three little kids. And it would say, want a real live Christmas present? And another one pictured a smiling little boy grasping a ball under the headline, yours for the asking. And they would advertise these kids nationally, show you pictures so that you could buy these kids, you know, contact her and buy the kids. And another scheme that she had, she would show several of the kids in an ad, and they ran a raffle contest.
Yeah.
So you would buy a raffle ticket like for $25 and put it in, and you might win one of these kids. Instead of having to pay the full price. But she made all kinds of money because they would run this nationally.
Yeah.
So we'd get all these $25 tickets sold, and then maybe they'd give away a kid or two.
Part of her network, they would actually go and rent hotel rooms like in New York City and places like that and set up and have interviews for these people, these parents that wanted to come and wanted to adopt. So it was a nationwide racket.
Now, a lot of these kids, like say, some ended up maybe better off because they ended up in better homes with, you know, well-to-do parents and things like that. But she didn't really care where they went to if the price was right. And a lot of them got adopted out to pedophiles, people of dubious character and stuff like that. And they're basically sold into what I'm sure was a terrible life.
Absolutely. And the sad thing about this is that during this period, these adoptions were essentially closed adoptions, sometimes also called confidential adoptions. And this is when the child is adopted by another family and the record of the biological parents is kept sealed.
Mm-hmm.
This actually used to be the most traditional and popular way that adoptions were done. And it doesn't give the child any ability to go back and look up their actual records.
Right. And it also, anybody that had any thoughts about, hey, this doesn't look right, or I think something funny's going on, they don't have any way to look at anything to do any investigating.
No, if there was somebody from the press who got wind of this and wanted to try to investigate it, these are sealed records. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the perfect crime, really, to help seal these things up. Now, adoptions here in West Virginia, there's a very strict procedure the way they're done, and there has to be a petition filed in the court, and it has to go to a hearing in front of the judge and in circuit court. And there also has to be some sort of publication and notice to all people who might have any kind of potential interest in the child. So, for example, if the biological parents were known, then they would actually have right to come to the hearing and be heard. Now, if their rights were terminated or they relinquished their rights, then they wouldn't. But they have to put those documents into the court record to show to the judge to satisfy that all parties have received notice. So I think in the current process we have in West Virginia, I don't think you would be able to get away with this. Probably not in any state now at this point.
Well, she would make up whole new birth certificates for them, though, and put down a fake name for the mother and father and put down a new name for the child and stuff like that. So, you know, if you did make a public announcement, you wouldn't recognize it from that.
No, but you would also have to give some sort of notice to the biological mother or the biological father. Anybody that was on the up and up would say, well, what happened to the mother? Where is the mother?
Mm-hmm.
So
in those days, they didn't ask.
No, they didn't ask. They didn't have the procedures set up. And this, there was probably
you didn't
a lot
have
of
the communication that you have now, too.
No, the internet's made that pretty.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, in the 30s and 40s, how did you communicate this stuff? Go out in the middle of the town and yell it or something, you know?
Telegram.
Yeah. I mean, but you wouldn't know who to send it to. You know, it was hard to make public notice like that. I mean, other than the newspaper was the only thing, but I would imagine there was a lot of, if you lived in a shanty town, as they called it, you didn't get the newspaper, I doubt.
No, you weren't taking the daily news.
Yeah. Yeah. That was probably the least of your worries.
Well, it does show this whole story about who was preyed upon by this. And that was the less fortunate, the people that didn't have the means.
Right.
They weren't the ones that could hire a lawyer to help fight this in court, to have somebody fix it. I mean, they were taken advantage of.
Yeah, you came across one other person that was involved in this that was of some note our listeners may have heard of.
That's right. The wrestler known as Ric Flair.
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah. They said that his parents were had adopted. Now, I didn't read the part that said that he was one they had adopted, just that his parents had adopted one from him.
He was born on February 25th, 1949, in Memphis, Tennessee. His birth name is widely believed to be Fred Phillips, although on different documents, he is also credited as Fred DeMarie or Stewart, while his biological parents were Luther and Olive Phillips. So that was also, there's a little bit of confusion about what his biological parents' name was. And I'm reading this from a Wikipedia article, so I assume this is correct. But he was adopted, and at the time of his adoption, which was arranged by the Tennessee Children's Home Society as part of Georgia Tan's baby kidnapping operation, his adoptive father, Dr. Richard Reed Flair, was completing a residency in Detroit, Michigan. So this is another person who was adopted, but fortunately ended up in probably a better home than maybe what he was taken from. But it really doesn't go into the fact of what happened to his parents or anything like that. So we just know that who they were. But yeah, Ric Flair was part of this.
Well, he was another one. I hadn't really heard of this guy, but this one could have gone either way. It was Frank Needy, who was also known as the Enforcer. He was a mobster.
Yeah, he's in the Untouchables.
Oh, okay. Well, he was also adopted a son named Joseph from Georgia Tan.
Really?
Yeah. But here's what I thought was kind of crazy is the way that this started coming to light was the new governor of Tennessee was elected, Governor Gordon Browning. And he had heard some of these things going on that, you know, there were people talking by now. This had been going on 20 years. So, and there was a lot of people involved.
Yeah.
And with a lot of people involved, there's a lot of people that can talk. So there was a lot of rumors flying around. So he put together a task force to investigate to see what was going on.
And he was a political rival of Crump as well.
So he had motivation.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to bring Crump down along with it.
Yeah.
So they started this investigation. Well, she ended up dying 3 days before any charges were filed against her, that this report had been completed. Well, she ended up dying of cancer right before this came out. You know, all this stuff that had happened, and yet they still had her, you know, like I say, they had the report that said all this stuff, but her obituary in the paper still mentioned that she had run the Memphis branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society for 26 years, and that the veteran social worker died at her home, and that she had operated the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis since 1924, during which time she had placed more than 5,000 babies for adoption and was recognized as a national authority on adoption laws. So they're still piling the praise on her and about what a great person she was and everything. And of course, when this report came out, what all was in there, here's the one thing that the new governor did, though, that was maybe a little questionable. He sealed all the names that were involved in it.
Yeah.
Even though they had found the corruption with police officers and with court officials and judges and everything else, they sealed all that and didn't make any of the names of what they found available to the public because they didn't want to have to pay all the lawsuits. State of Tennessee would have been liable for all that.
One of the co-conspirators was a judge named Camille Kelly, and she was a juvenile judge in Shelby County, Tennessee for 30 years, and she was one of the co-conspirators. And she worked really closely with Georgia Tan during this entire time. And on November 11th, 1950, she kind of quietly resigned from the bench.
Mm-hmm. Because she knew what was coming. But she never suffered any ill effects because everything was sealed.
Yeah. No one was actually ever prosecuted for their roles in the whole scandal. It's just absolutely crazy.
But to think that there could be that many, 5,000 babies are what estimated went through there, and 500 of them died. They found a mass grave on the property.
Yeah.
There was so many kids in there, they couldn't even get an accurate count at the time when they found it. And they said that there were many more that the bodies had been disposed of elsewhere.
Yeah.
Because they just didn't care. And a lot of times, too, they felt like that they were dealing with the attractiveness of the child. That was what they sold them on. So they wanted their children all to be skinny, which was more attractive than if they had obese children.
Yeah.
So they would starve them.
She actually put out catalogs, too, I think, at some point, where you could pick your child from a catalog.
Yeah.
I mean, she was essentially treating these children like livestock. I mean, basically.
Only other thing I could compare it to is a pet store.
Yeah.
You just put them in there and you say, here, what do you like? You have, what's her name, singing in the background that they have in all those animal commercials there about buying an animal.
Oh, yeah.
Sarah
McLaughlin.
Yeah, Sarah McLaughlin, yeah.
Yeah.
That she's singing in the background there showing these children. I mean, it's just unbelievable to me that it can operate on such a massive scale, so many people involved, and for so many years, for 20 years. It's one thing if you got away with it for a year or two.
Yeah.
But for 20 years, this went on.
Well, I think it was the perfect storm of technology.
Lack thereof,
and medical research, and just people's ideas, and the fact that we hadn't really seen the atrocities of war. And I mean, I think it was just the perfect storm of everything that allowed this to happen.
Well, she ended up making millions of dollars off of it.
She did.
And was very well to do. And a lot of other people made money off of it as well. Yeah. So
some of which we'll never know.
No, but that's really a black eye in our history of what was allowed to do to children in that area for that amount of time.
Oh, for sure. I would like to think that it would probably never happen in this day and age.
Well, I don't think it could because of communications, because of laws that are in place, and then the whole thing that you're not institutionalizing children and putting them in an orphanage and putting them at the discretion of one person like that.
That's true. And I think in this day and age that it's so many different people are involved in adoptions and things like that, you couldn't keep it quiet. Mm-hmm. There was somebody that would stand up and say, at least you'd think there would be, somebody right. would stand up and say, whoa, 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 this isn't right. What's going on here?
Yeah, there's a lot more red tape now than there was then.
Exactly.
People could just fill out papers and send them in. You know, how many people had Social Security numbers, you know, especially kids.
Yeah.
Because when I was a kid, you didn't have to have a Social Security number until you were 18.
Yeah, I had a great-grandfather. We're doing some research. He had two or three of them.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well,
he's getting a couple different checks, I think.
Well, that's a good job if you can get it. Good gig if you can get it.
That's good work if you can get it.
Yeah. 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 You just never know. But.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions about some of the things we talked about. And this one is going to be interesting.
I was wondering what phrase you were going to use for that.
Who is perceived by many to be the greatest wrestler of all time?
Ric Flair.
That's right. And do you know what his catchphrase is?
No, but I know he used to wear those feather boas.
Woo!
Oh,
he makes the woo sound.
That's a heck of a catchphrase.
Yeah.
Woo! That's all he could think of?
I thought that's it for Legal Briefs. No, that's not it for Legal Briefs. That's just what I wanted to lead off.
No, I mean, that's it? That's all of a catchphrase?
Well,
there's not many words of wisdom in there.
He had more, but that's what he's kind of known for, is like that.
That's it, huh?
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Actually, I ran into him one time at a bar at Myrtle Beach.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did he body slam you or anything?
He did not. I was actually standing next to him at a urinal, and I had a friend that looked like Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I mean, I swear this guy looked just like him. He was a little bit smaller, but in the face, he looked just like him. And earlier in the night, my friend had gone up to Ric Flair and said, then done the raised his eyebrow and said something like, you know, hey, what's going on, jabroni? And Ric Flair just looked at him and shook his head and walked off. It didn't even like, cause he looked just like him. Like, mm-hmm. You know, he could have very easily just kind of laughed, but he was kind of not very nice about it. So we were standing there at the urinal, I looked over, I said, hey, did you see The Rock was here tonight? He's like, Rock's not here. Rock's in Birmingham. I was like, whatever.
They keep track of each other.
I was like, whatever, man. I walked off.
You're not supposed to talk to people at the urinal. That breaks man code.
When you're standing at a urinal next to Ric Flair, you talk to him.
No, you keep to yourself, and you maintain one urinal spacing in between.
He was probably a little weirded out by that.
I would have been weirded out. I would have just said, stay on your side there, bud.
All right. So what is the time required before relinquishing your parental rights in West Virginia?
72 hours.
That's right. Nailed that one.
Well, you know, I remembered you saying that because I was remembered thinking that's about 3 days.
Just about.
Now, Just barely.
What states can you still read the law and become a lawyer that way?
Well, now I won't remember all these. I remember you said Virginia was one of them.
That's right.
And D.C. is one of them.
No.
Or you said Washington.
Correct.
Okay, so that's not D.C. That's Washington, the state.
Correct.
Not the district. And California is one, because that's where Kim Kardashian is. She writes me about that on a regular basis, how she's progressing. We're pen pals.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Kanye, too.
You and Kanye?
Yeah. We're still trying to figure out how to get Zuckerberg's $20 million. What else?
There's one more.
Iowa?
Vermont.
Vermont. I knew there was one more.
Yeah, you're pretty close.
Well, I wasn't very close Iowa to Vermont, but that's pretty far. But the other three I got, that's a 75%.
And what is a closed adoption?
Closed adoption means the records are sealed and you can't see who the parents were or anything else about the adoption or the reasons or the people or anything like that, any information.
Now, can you tell me more about it? Like it's whether it's in vogue or not?
It is in vogue. Most people want closed adoptions so they can't go back and look things up. But the the child themselves are able to get access to it, I believe.
Well, the current climate is basically that closed adoption is not in the best interest of the child. Oh. That it should be okay for the child to know their history and where they're from, essentially.
Well, that's what I mean. Other people can't get to it, but the child should be able to.
The child should be able to. But in a true closed adoption, the child can't either.
Hmm.
So it's completely sealed. So. Hmm.
Yeah, you should be able to find out information about yourself.
I think so, too.
It should be your right.
Well, that's going to do it for Legal Briefs. You actually
pretty good much, okay.
Yeah, pretty okay.
Pretty okay.
Good enough for a woo.
Woo. Well, now, is that going to be your catchphrase?
No. We know my catchphrase is.
That dog just don't hunt.
Exactly. One day I'll get to use that from the bench.
Well, I want to come watch you when you're on the bench one day and you get to use that phrase.
That dog don't hunt. Bag the gavel. Or bang the gavel. Bag the gavel.
You got to learn the right terms before you can be the judge
I'm not ready to be the judge yet.
You choked. First chance to use it, you just choked.
I don't even know what I'm supposed to do with the gavel. Put it in a bag. I don't know.
The guy that gets out of line, hit him in the head with it. That's the best thing to do. Bring hit order to his court.
Bring order to his head.
Yeah.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought is guys making up their own rules. I am constantly amazed by some of the yahoos around here and the way they can just make up their own rules for things. The logic, or lack thereof, is befuddling. As an example, the other day I was driving down the street and there was a guy on a motorcycle driving down the sidewalk. He wasn't just moving it from his driveway to another part of the yard or something like that. He was getting around town this way. Now, I passed this knothead on the way to the bank, and about 8 blocks down the road while sitting in the bank drive-thru, here he came, still motivating along. He was not driving the speed limit or anything. He was moving at a slow rate of speed, but nonetheless, he was driving a motorcycle on the sidewalk. His motorcycle had no license plate on it, and he had no helmet on. We do have a mandatory helmet law for motorcycles, so he was breaking at least 2 laws that I know of. But I believe he was absolutely unaware of it. I think that in his mind, the motorcycle wasn't licensed, so he couldn't drive it on the street. But no one said you have to have a license to drive it on the sidewalk. I mean, you can walk on it without a license, so why not just ride on it? He also probably figured that he didn't have to comply with the helmet law because he was just basically a two-wheeled pedestrian. The only thing I will give him credit for is the fact he was driving slowly. If he had been evil Knieveling down the sidewalk, now, that surely would have gotten some bad attention from someone. I hope so, anyway. But he was just puttering along, about the speed of one of those little motorized shopping cart things like at Walmart. I don't know what you call those things, but they really seem to have grown in popularity the last few years because they are constantly trying to run over you in Walmart, and especially at Disney. So he wasn't driving any faster than a person with a good one of those things motoring down the sidewalk. That is why I think that he thought it was fine. If he moves the same speed as those things go, then why should he have to have the 3- or 4-wheeled cart when he could just do it on 2 wheels? Sure, that makes sense. I mean, if handicapped people on those carts can drive down the sidewalk on one of those, then it would be discrimination if he couldn't be an able-bodied guy riding a 2-wheeler down the sidewalk. Perfect sense, right? All I could think was, where is a cop when you need one? I do have good reason to be upset about this screwed up kind of logic that some individuals operate with. I had gotten a new car about 10 years ago and only had it about 3 months when I was driving down by the park one day and was following a woman driving about 10 miles an hour. Now this was already frustrating, but then on top of that, my wife put my mints back in the wrong spot on my console. So of course I had to look down and get them and move them to the correct spot. Let me add that I believe she intentionally put them in the wrong spot just because she knew it would get to me and I wouldn't be able to stand it. So she is mostly to blame for what happened next. I looked back up after just looking down for maybe 2 seconds, and there was the rear of that car stopped right in the middle of the road. There was no intersection or car ahead or anything. It was just a straight stretch of road, and this lady just came to a complete stop for no apparent reason. So, of course, I ran right into the back of her car. I don't think I even had a chance to hit the brakes before impact. It pretty much tore the entire grill out of my new car, but did relatively little damage to that boat she was driving. Her husband was a passenger, and he got out of the car first. And boy, was I mad. I said, "Look at my new car!" He said, "I'm sorry, but you hit us." I said, "I know, but you stopped in the middle of the road for no apparent reason." He said, "Well, we saw a pothole ahead, and we stopped to try to find a good place on the sidewalk to drive to avoid it." What? I don't know about you, but I say there is no good place on the sidewalk to drive a car when avoiding a pothole. The sidewalk just doesn't come into play in your route planning considerations for safe driving. So the wreck was my fault for not recognizing that people may just want to stop at any time, anywhere, to drive on the sidewalk. Just like old Motorcycle Boy. As an old coach used to say, it's hard to soar with the eagles when you're surrounded by turkeys. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.